This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Argo Studios in New York City. Happy New Year, everybody! There are great stories of change and redemption in our world, and there are great storytellers. It's a rare blessing when those characteristics are concentrated in one person, but one such person is poet and best-selling author Mary Carr. I was happy to take advantage of our stay in New York City to invite Mary onto the show, and happier still when she agreed. The author of books including Lit, A Memoir, and The Liars Club will join us in the studio just a little later in the show. But first, one of the particularly heartless battles of the culture wars involves recent attacks on the national organization Planned Parenthood, with a laser focus on the fact that this service organization provides safe, legal abortion services. A tiny percentage of Planned Parenthood services, by the way, far-right groups and leaders would sacrifice the access the organization offers to birth control, education, health screenings, and other important services for predominantly low-income women just to advance a radical agenda. Once again, the relentless activism is couched in moral and religious language, a particular kind of moral and religious language. I'm not sure what church teaches the virtues of working for more unplanned pregnancies, unwanted babies, undetected infections, and cancers, but one line of the attack on Planned Parenthood centers on discrediting the founder of the organization, Margaret Sanger, calling her a racist supporter of eugenics. Now, bluntly, as a white woman bent on facilitating the killing of black babies. And this message has been aimed at undermining support for Planned Parenthood in minority communities nationwide. You know, the truth about the life and intent of Planned Parenthood's founder aren't that hard to research. And the fact is, she was working in a religion-driven, anti-woman environment that could be the model for the end result of many of today's theocratic initiatives. For the facts, we turn to Ellen Chesler. She literally wrote the book on the subject. It's called Woman of Valor, Margaret Sanger and the Birth Control Movement in America. Dr. Chesler is a distinguished scholar, writer, educator. Dr. Chesler is also a member of the board of Planned Parenthood. I'm delighted she is in the studio with me today. Welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Regarding the accusations being thrown at Margaret Sanger, did I get those right?
Well, you certainly got the accusations right, but I do want to say by way of context before we even get to the history, 80% of women support Planned Parenthood, 80% of young people under the age of 40 80% of minorities, because they are the beneficiaries of its services. Let's put this in some context. I'm not a completely competitive person, but 9% of America supports Congress. So we're doing okay.
That is a great point, that a lot of the people throwing the harshest criticism and the most sharpened darts are people who really don't know what Planned Parenthood does.
Well, I think there are people who want to reverse the extraordinary progress that women have made in this country as a result of the services Planned Parenthood provides, and also, in some measure, perhaps are threatened not only by what the organization does for women, but by its social and economic impacts. If you can have only the number of children you can love, afford to support, educate, and employ, many of the other unfortunate outcomes of unwanted children never happen. I mean, we can educate our kids better. We can find things for them to do. All the cohesion that families provide can be provided. Let me put this now in a historical context and take it to Sanger. In many ways, my 600-page biography of Margaret Sanger, which was written 20 years ago but has remained in print, is a study of how a secular movement clashes with traditional values and not only overvalues but also over power relationships. For the longest time, the province of sexuality and reproduction was the province of the churches. Family relationships, marriage, childbearing, were governed by the churches. In the 20th century, as in many aspects of life, secular and scientific values and agents, you know, doctors, social scientists, social welfare workers, supplanted the role that clerics had long performed. And this was a contest for power. So what happens, you know, from the day that she opens up her clinic in Brooklyn in 1916 and goes to jail after 450 women line up wanting these services, she's accused of being an anti-Semite. She's married to a Jew, by the way. When you don't want to take on a woman's argument and ideology, it's easy to assassinate her character. And we've seen this over and over again in American history, and women are particularly vulnerable, not just women. This happens to men as well. So there's always this accusation. She quickly moves into a mode where she builds an organization across the country when she defends her jail term on appeal and wins the right of physicians. She actually wanted nurses to be included in this legal ruling. But physicians are given the right to prescribe contraception for reasons of health. And she builds a national movement, the American Birth Control League, it's called, clinics on the ground in cities all across the country that federate in a national organization, which in the 1940s changes its name to Planned Parenthood, picking up on the pronatalist sentiments after many years of depression and war in this country. So that's the large history. But through that period, she lobbies all of the churches, and all of the progressive religions fall into place. They come to understand that this, they don't have to be afraid of this. They have to join it. There is a holdout. The big holdout in this country is the Catholic Church, which makes Sanger enemy number one. You know, there's a way of looking at Sanger as the mother of the modern American Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church, which has resolutely stayed out of politics in this country, organizes the National Catholic Welfare Conference to fight contraception and to fight her advocacy of changing laws, laws that had been passed in the 19th century to define obscenity and included contraception and abortion.
Dr. Chesler, talk about the role of race in all of this.
Margaret Sanger was an advanced thinker about race in her day. When she, in a segregated society, both North and South in the 1930s, she opened up the first integrated birth control clinic in Harlem with W.E.B. Du Bois, the head of the NAACP, doing the ribbon cutting. When racist white Southern state officials denied any of the benefits of the New Deal to African-Americans, to Negroes, as they were then respectfully called, she opened up a Negro project so that women could have health care in the rural South. She did this with the behind-the-scenes support of Eleanor Roosevelt. Margaret Sanger was not a racist. Margaret Sanger did embrace what was some universally held beliefs of the 1920s that strike us as quite anachronistic and strange today, about eugenics. She was controversial for her position about birth control. Eugenics gave her status in a society of progressives who embraced the idea that in a world where, you know, we had come to understand that we evolution, that Charles Darwin reigned, that human beings could be improved if only we applied the right tools. And this was a progressive idea because it meant that you would have rights and opportunities in as Americans, as Democrat, in a democratic society, not attached to birthright, to your social or economic station, but to your ability. So what's the big legacy of the eugenics movement? IQ tests. The stuff that made me, child of immigrants, you know, get into Vassar and Columbia because I scored well. Every college and university taught courses in eugenics. Obviously, post-Nazi Germany, this all fell into disrepute. But there is a way in which the right wing and African-Americans who don't embrace these ideas but embraced a kind of black nationalist agenda, this actually gets started with the Black Panthers in the 1970s and some feminist scholars who buy into this notion that this is all about racial genocide or ethnic genocide. Race has been the defining factor of the 20th century in America, and hopefully we're getting beyond it. We've elected an African-American president. There's much better values and more rights-based philosophies in our politics today. But there are these legacies.
Ellen Chesler is a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Her writing appears widely in leading publications. She's the author of Woman of Valor, Margaret Sanger and the Birth Control Movement in America. Dr. Chesler, thanks for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
We've got to take a short break, but coming right up, there is an interview you must not miss. I'll be joined by poet and memoirist Mary Carr. Extended versions and transcripts of most of our interviews are available online at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. You know, it's not easy to write a book, and there are special challenges when the subject is autobiographical and the life that's revealed includes experiences that are painful and uncomfortable. The stories of self that poet and author Mary Carr reveals in her books are powerful and challenging. Her memoir, The Liar's Club, was a New York Times bestseller for over a year and was named one of the year's best books. Her third book, published in 2009, is Lit, a memoir which, she says, details my journey from black belt sinner and lifelong agnostic to unlikely Catholic. And I am very pleased to welcome Mary Carr to State of Belief Radio today. Mary, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Welton. Always good to see a man from Louisiana.
I should tell these people that this isn't the first time we've met and that we're friends.
We're old friends. We go way back now.
Yeah, that's right. And you know what? You offer so many different opportunities for discussion. We could deal with a dysfunctional family background. We could deal with moving away from drugs, teaching as a respected professor in a university, a devotee of Roman Catholic spirituality, and interest in a maturing spirituality, writing best-selling books. Mary, talk about integration. How do you keep all that together?
Well, I only get paid by one person at a time, so whoever, and I'm a little bit of a hooker here, Welton. I mean that in the best way. Whoever's paying me gets me. So I'm only doing this for free because I like you. But, well, no. uh, But no, so I mean, when I'm working on a book of memoir, I'm that's all I do. When I'm teaching, I don't write because I find I resent my students if I do. I can work on poems like when I'm traveling or something when I'm writing because I travel back and forth between Syracuse and New York. But basically, I have a very good ability to concentrate, and I just shut out every other thing when I'm doing whatever it is I'm doing. And I usually have, I'm fortunate enough as a professor to have periods of time. What was hard was when my kid was little and I was teaching and writing and raising a baby and painting the house, you know, doing everything a single mom does. Yeah. So.
Well, people who have read your books and poetry know that you changed in a dramatic way. Why, when, and how did that change occur?
Wow. Those are hard questions. I changed because it was change or die. It was adapt or die. It was a Darwinian deal. I had a little baby. I was in the middle of drinking myself to death. My daddy drank himself to death. My mother, we wished would have died and didn't. Shot up the house instead. We had bullet holes all over the house. Thanks. She shot at whoever she dated. And she didn't date. She married. She married seven times. So that's the dysfunctional family part. And, I found myself in my early 30s. In some ways, I looked as if I were together. I was married to a big Harvard hockey player, looked like something you win at a raffle. and I had a baby boy, and I was teaching at Tufts and Harvard and in the academic ghetto. But I wanted to blow my brains out every day. I was very depressed. I realized when I finally got sober, I'd been depressed my whole life. And the only way I could get sober, I tried everything and some self-help groups and which I usually don't talk about very much. But I noticed that the people who didn't drink, who didn't want to blow their brains out and weren't mad, all had a spiritual practice. Maybe they were Buddhist, or maybe they just meditated every day, or they did a lot of charity work, but they had some active spiritual practice that involved not themselves alone, but other people. Mm-hmm. And so it was suggested to me that I get on my knees and pray. And I had never prayed in my life. So I didn't know you couldn't cuss and swear. I didn't know you weren't supposed to do the double eagle fingers up in the air at God and holler. And in a way, it was a very honest conversation that I had with God from the very beginning. And something started to happen when I prayed. And the only way, I can only describe it physically. The great thing about Catholicism, I became Catholic eventually, was it's carnal. It's all about the body. And God came to me where I was. I was in a state of real despair, and I would get these moments of quiet that I now think of as sacred moments. And it was the only quiet I'd ever had in my life. Hmm. And I didn't call it God. Mm-hmm. I thought I was curing myself of alcoholism with biofeedback. Like, that's what I would have told you. Yeah. I wouldn't have had a sacred or religious spin on it. But I just kept going back to that well. It's kind of like the story of the woman in the well in the Bible. You know, it's where the water was. And I kept going back there because I was having a hard time raising a kid.
Mm. When did you discover that you're a good writer?
Well, I still haven't quite discovered that. I think I guess I always wanted to write, and I always wrote a little bit better than the people my age. So I still wouldn't call myself, I think of a good writer as, you know, Don DeLillo or Harper Lee or, you know, I don't know, Ralph Ellis. You know, I still don't think myself as a good writer, but I'm better than I would be if I didn't write more than once, I guess.
So you don't mind, though, if some of us think you are a good writer?
I hope you all do. I hope you all spend a lot of money buying my books, and I'm sure you'll enjoy them all, but you just at least buy them.
Yeah. We've got to take a short break, but we'll continue with Mary Carr in just a minute. Be right back. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. I'm talking with poet, essayist, and best-selling author Mary Carr. Why do you write? I mean, now I know what you said. You have the hooker mentality and all that, but you don't write just to make money, do you?
No, I mean, I started reading, I think, because I was lonely and my house was lonely. And it was a place I could go. And especially when I read poetry, you know, I was a depressed child, very depressed. I had a suicide attempt as a child. And with a bunch of aspirin, nothing serious, relatively speaking. No one even knew, you know, what had happened. But when I read poetry, if you're very depressed, you have a hard time concentrating and you can't read longer things. And to hear how somebody felt I could connect with another person emotionally when I read a poem. And to some extent, that connection with language and with the imagined other is what permitted me to enter into prayer, I think, in some ways. It was a natural thing for me to do, to be speaking to somebody or feel like I was in communion with somebody I couldn't see.
Hmm. You have a great following for your blog, and you're always as unconventional there as you are surprising everywhere else. Who is the audience, and what's the message on that blog?
Well, it's interesting. It's not a very literary audience, even though the repartee is very literary. It's a lot of people from very different beliefs. Some people are atheist. Some people do yoga. You know, there are some very fundamentalist Christians. I have a couple of friends I know are Pentecostal from where I grew up. But it's also people who are Catholic. I have priests and nuns and I mean, the message of my church and of yours, too, is a message, and of Jesus in general, but also of Muhammad and of every other faith, is that we're supposed to love and tolerate each other's differences. And so when I feel myself getting my back up, even if somebody is homophobic, say, which, as you know, I was a groomsman in my friend Shelley Wright's wedding recently.
Right.
So, you know, somebody said to me at one point, you know, what do you think about your supportive, you know, gay rights is when these people are sinners and they're going to burn in hell. And I said, you know what? Maybe you're right. But obviously I don't see it that way, but I would like us to be able to continue talking to each other, despite our differences. I see it as my decision on that blog to try to welcome everybody's beliefs, no matter what they are, even if they disagree with me.
You want to tell people what the blog?
It's on Facebook, Mary Carr Litt.
This is a strange question, but is guilt a part of your life?
Oh, well, shame is.
Shame is.
You know, it's funny. Yeah, I mean, that's the great thing about being Catholic.
Well, that's why I'm asking you that.
Yeah. It is. And we're good at guilt. Y'all are good at being good-natured, much more than we are.
Don't generalize.
No, I mean, y'all can grin and get on with it. Your music's more fun. You know, you have better fellowship, you Protestants. By you, I mean you Protestants.
Well, why are you a Catholic?
They spoke to me. The body on the cross, I'll be honest with you. My mother, I remember her saying when I became Catholic, you go up, there's that gory, bloody, butchered body on the cross. I mean, I worship the resurrected Christ. And I was like, well, we all do, but where are we? And for me, I suffer a lot. I just do. I have a dark mentality. I'm not a good-natured individual. I'm socially adroit, but not particularly good-natured, not easygoing. I do want to kill everybody on the subway when it's hot and they have my seat. And so I understand suffering. And so for me, and also the bodiliness of it, to be honest with you, standing up and kneeling down and like breathing in and saying prayers together with people, which I know for your people often mm-hmm. seems like cat-like or rote or, you know, like these kind of big brother monsters, not being individual and having an individual connection with the Lord,
yeah.
but just kind of going through the motions. But for me, as somebody who really secretly believes that I am the center of the universe, mm-hmm. that's actually a good thing. Hmm. For somebody like me and my spiritual practice, I walk into church. Here's the way I describe it. You know how when you go to the state fair and you see everybody and you're like, oh, my Lord, who are these people?
Yeah.
Eating the fried dough. And then you have a moment. I don't know if it's when you're eating cotton candy and you see somebody else. For me, it's either on the bumper cars or at the end of the night in the little fairs. They'll have fireworks mm-hmm. and everybody looks up and is going, ah, you know, and they're in a state of awe together. And you look at them and you say, you know, I am kin to these people. These people are like me. And I walk into church and I think, and I hate everybody and I leave and I don't. So it's literally 100% has nothing to do with doctrine or ideology. It's entirely to do with practice.
Mm-hmm.
The practice of it, for me, makes me a better person.
So you can put up with a conservative theology even though you have a pretty liberal social ethic.
Well, the church is very different. As you know, despite the doctrine, I don't think of the Pope as the church, and I don't think of the ideology or doctrine. It's also, you know, I think of it as the people, and my church is also very good about working with the poor, very mm-hmm. good at mm-hmm. it. And we often, there is such a thing as liberation theology.
Right.
And actually, I just saw a survey where Catholic parishes are more tolerant of gay people than most every other parish, including Jewish, Protestant, which was surprising to me, but that there are more gay and lesbian masses and AIDS hospices and stuff like that. So not in every church, obviously, mm-hmm. but I guess certainly I'm in New York City. Dorothy Day had the Catholic Worker downtown. So, you know, all hierarchies are annoying to me. I'm an outlaw by nature. So to be an outlaw in the Catholic Church is kind of an easy. There are a lot of us.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Are you a feminist?
Sure. Yeah.
And what does that mean?
Well, I think it's harder to be a girl than it is a boy. It's harder to be black than to be white. Harder to be a girl than to be a boy. You know, harder to be poor than is to be rich. Mm-hmm. You know, harder to be short than to be tall. You know what yeah. I mean? Just all. So, and I, as a young girl, you know, for instance, I've always supported myself. Mm-hmm. No man I've ever been with has ever paid my bills. And so I believe in the equality of women. So, yeah. Do okay. I think women ought to be priests? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Are you political?
Not so much. I mean, I think, certainly, like, for instance, on my blog or in my writing, I'm not a very good politician. It bores me. I find it very tedious. So, but for instance, I have a very good priest friend who's a Dominican, who's a very conservative in terms of doctrine guy, and yet is spiritually still very advanced and very tolerant. And we argue, but there's kind of no malice in it. So I'm not that political. I'm probably not as political as I ought to be.
I see. What do you read?
Oh, I read everything. You know, I'm reading right now a book on Revelations. It's about to come out by Elaine Pagels, the great Christian theologian, I think.
She's been working on that one a while.
She's been working on it 9 years. Yeah. And I just went to Princeton and spoke to her seminar, and she gave me a copy of The Galley. It's an amazing book.
Yeah.
It is, it's going to mess up your people.
Yeah.
The way the conservative movement has I think often the fundamentalist movement has kind of appropriated the book of Revelations. And she puts so much of it in historical context.
Yeah.
And she's so immersed in all the prophets, I think, mm-hmm. and such a great biblical scholar.
Just so you'll know, you're hacking off some people by calling them my people. They don't think I am. But
they don't think you're a Protestant.
That's right.
You're Baptist.
No, they can't. That doesn't make sense to them.
What are you then?
I'm a Baptist and I'm a Christian, and
right.
So that's. But you know, there are some people that disagree on that. Just like some people would say
disagree on me.
You can't be a good Catholic or a good Christian. So what's your take on contemporary religion?
Well. See, since I didn't know what it was like before, it's kind of hard to know. It seems to me like we're all too dug in, you know. And again, one of the things that I've been interested in on my Facebook page is seeing people of all these different places when you post something and people kind of get their fur ruffled. And then you'll see them kind of all start to come around and come to consensus or come to agreement, come to accept ideas that oppose theirs. I mean, I remember before I was baptized, I went to see an old nun who was about 80 years old, and I was on something called the Peace and Social Justice Committee in this church, even before I was baptized, and with the Berrigans. At that time, Jerry Berrigan is mm-hmm. a member of that parish. And this old nun was raising money for AIDS ministry in Africa, and someone said, well, don't you think these people are going to burn in hell because they haven't been baptized, and more or less, I mean, they said mm-hmm. that. And she said, you know, when I was a young sister and I moved to Africa, I used to think that way. And now I think, you know, the Holy Spirit assumes many forms. And for me, that's the great thing about a tripartite God mm-hmm. is there is the Holy Spirit is a female pronoun mm-hmm. for one mm-hmm. in the Greek, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it does assume many forms. It's not so nailed down, and it is where God, I think, speaks to us all in our hearts.
Mary Carr, I can't thank you enough for being with us on State of Belief Radio today.
Thank you, Welton. God bless.
God bless you.
Thank you.
We've got to take a short break. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. Okay, here's one for you. As if they didn't have anything else to do or anything better to do, members of Congress recently acted to help our nation by reaffirming a second resolution making In God We Trust the official motto of the United States. Oh, you say you didn't know the motto was under attack? Neither did I. And you think Congress had better things to do? I'm with you there also. So what the heck was going on here? Well, first, a brief bit of history. The phrase, In God We Trust, has been on the coins of our nation since 1864. At that point, Congress was bargaining with God to seek some divine blessing that would help override the immense human suffering and division fomented by the Civil War. If we put the name of God on our coins, the reasoning went, maybe God will help us. Then amid the era of everyone is going to church in the 1950s, the phrase on the coin was added to the nation's currency as well, preceded, if you recall, by adding one nation under God to the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. Once again, our nation's leaders were trying to make a deal with God, as if with their best-giving lobbyists. A booming Christianity in the United States was occurring in the midst of a growing fear, a massive paranoia related to communism. So eager to distinguish ourselves from the Soviet Union even more clearly, thinking democracy was not enough of a distinction, again, congressional leaders sought to strike a bargain with God. We'll put your name on our currency, they said to God. We'll say your name in our pledge to the flag, and we'll confess our trust in you so that you will bless us in our struggle with godless communism. Congress made the phrase, "In God We Trust," the motto of the nation in 1956. The passionate bargaining conveyed a disturbing message. Even if we don't act like people obedient to God, we want to say that's who we are. But all of it has been a hypocritical ploy based on a view of God that's not even represented in any major theistic religious tradition. The Hebrew psalmist declared, "Righteousness exalts a nation." That same truth resounded in the oracles of the great Hebrew prophets. And what is righteousness? It is to do justice, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to demonstrate compassion, to heal the sick, to lift up the poor. Now get this picture. In a nation reeling from unemployment and a repressed economy, as well as staggering figures related to an increase in poverty and the high costs of multiple wars, members of a Congress fostering budget cuts that will hurt most the weakest and poorest among us, the people for whom God has a bias, these people, these elected leaders with straight faces, these people who cannot even talk to each other because of the vitriol in their partisanship, these people who have opposed health care for everybody, these people who tolerate cheers for their words about ignoring the poor, these people without a hint of embarrassment on their faces took time to try and cover the multitude of their insensitivities by tipping their congressional hats to God and reaffirming a trust in God that is not reflected in the substance of the work they do. Now, maybe they thought God would be relieved to get a vote of confidence from them. Wrong. Maybe they thought God would be pleased with their action. Wrong again. God has made clear through the ages that such words are meaningless when unaccompanied by actions that demonstrate the kind of love and justice which God demands. What happened in the House of Representatives was pure, unadulterated politics. This was about elections more than religion, about partisanship rather than piety. Not everyone that wants to be identified with God wants to do the work that God inspires. As you would suspect and likely hope, the motto language has been challenged across our history. President Theodore Roosevelt objected to the use of "In God We Trust" on coins back in 1907. To quote Roosevelt, to put such a motto on coins or to use it in any kindred manner not only does no good but does positive harm and is in effect irreverence, which comes dangerously close to sacrilege. There have been challenges to this language that have even reached the Supreme Court. The decision to permit its continued use each time was ironically based on the premise that the words are so universally used in these contexts that they have, get this, that they have lost any specific meaning. In other words, the civil references to God, in fact, do not mean much more than just a habitual use of a known text. The Supreme Court has allowed this language to stand because it ruled the language doesn't mean anything. The references to God have nothing to do with religion, and thus does our motto doesn't constitute a violation of the separation of church and state, or it's not a compliment to God. So for the House of Representatives to go out of its way to vote on reaffirming this phrase as our national motto and taking the time to underscore, in effect, the importance of faith as the very core of our national identity runs directly counter to the reasoning that has allowed that phrase to even appear on our money and thus in our awareness in the first place. Folks, it's the same old story. Will we never learn? When you entangle religion and politics, institutions of religion and institutions of government, religion always loses. And politics doesn't fare much better. So Congress, enjoying a favorable view from less than 10% of the American people, once again has diverted its attention from the pressing business of this nation to boldly cast a vote of religious posturing that the nation was not requesting and that the members of Congress had no intent of following with actual legislation that reflects cooperation among them, compassion for the weakest and poorest among us, human concern about health and food, and justice for everybody. As a believer in God myself, I must ask for God's forgiveness for such mockery on the part of our political leaders. As one who respects non-theist American citizens, I must apologize for insensitivity. And as a Christian citizen, I must ask Congress to cease and desist from their religious hypocrisy and behave as responsible leaders who cooperate to do what is good for all the people in our country. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, read transcripts, sign up for our podcast. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices, so you can listen to it anywhere, anytime. Share your thoughts on what you've heard on Facebook and on Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line, 800-856-0277. We encourage you to tell others about the show and encourage them to listen to State of Belief Radio as a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, Happy New Year, everybody. And you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man.